It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on this Wednesday, the day after Election Day. We're going to talk about the elections in just a moment or so. Coming up later on the program today, we'll be chatting with Penn State Extension educator Maria Graziani. You realize that they're gearing up, helping farmers here in Pennsylvania to be able to make money on the craft beer industry that is growing in popularity here in Butler County and throughout the state. We'll talk about that with Maria later on the program. But first, we welcome Doug Saltzman to visit with us. We'll talk about yesterday's midterm elections. Doug Saltzman is a political and polling analyst. Doug, good to have you with us again here today.
Good to be on with you, Dave. And frankly, after all this politics, I think I'd rather talk about craft beer. But, you know, I guess I'll do what I'm told.
I was ready for a craft beer after our late-night election coverage last night.
I had a couple when I was all done. Never drink when you're on the air. You never know what you're going to say. But when it was all done last night at about 2 a.m., and I did my last interview with a station out on the West Coast, I had a couple.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what happened here in Pennsylvania. I think folks have heard quite a bit about what's happened nationally, and we'll touch on that. But I'd like to talk about, utilize your expertise to talk about Pennsylvania. First of all, in the gubernatorial race, it was a pretty decisive victory for Democratic incumbent Governor Tom Wolf over Republican challenger Scott Wagner. I don't know what your thoughts are, Doug. I was not surprised by that because the polls leading up to, even the day before, seemed to indicate that that Casey had a double-digit lead.
You're talking about the governor's race or the Senate race?
I'm sorry, did I say Casey? Wolf, yes. I'm talking about the gubernatorial race, the governor's race.
Right. The only thing that surprised me was the margin of victory. I thought it might close some from the polling, but it didn't. It was an overwhelming victory for the governor. Which is not uncommon in Pennsylvania. Of course, Tom Corbett, who lost re-election 4 years ago, was the only incumbent governor to lose re-election since governors have been able to succeed themselves in the state, which has only been, you know, since 1970. So I was not surprised by the win. I was surprised by the total. I think at times Scott Wagner was his own worst enemy at times during the campaign, saying and doing things that didn't help his cause. But any time you're running against an incumbent governor in a booming economy, it's going to be tough to defeat that person.
Yeah, the margin was, Tom Wolf won by more than 800,000 votes. It was, pretty much a landslide. I think, and again, this is my layperson's analysis here, I think Wagner may have been mortally damaged in the primary. It was a tough fight last spring in the Republican primary, and he took a lot of heat there. What do you think?
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, Dave. And I said that multiple times last night as well. A lot of money was spent against him. It was very negative, maybe one of the most negative gubernatorial primaries I've seen. I don't think he ever fully recovered from that, given the amount of money that was spent against him then and then the amount of money that he had to raise to keep up with Governor Wolf. Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I think in hindsight now that primary hurt him. Tough primaries can sometimes help candidates. Ed Rendell had a very tough primary against Bob Casey Jr. for the governor's seat. He was way behind, caught up, won by 17 points, and then swept a victory against Mike Fisher that November. This time that didn't work for Scott Wagner.
Well, the Republicans in that primary last spring, they broke Ronald Reagan's cardinal rule. Never say anything bad about a fellow Republican, right?
Yeah, they sure did. And they broke it, I guess you could say, they broke it on steroids. I mean, they didn't just go subtly. It was a very, very negative campaign. And Paul Mango, frankly, probably would have won that had there hadn't been a third candidate in that race from the western part of the state as well. Mm-hmm. So Who knows what would have happened yesterday had Paul Mango been the candidate, but he clearly lost because of a third candidate in that race who got a small percentage of the vote, but enough that would have taken those votes from him, from Western Pennsylvania voters.
You also mentioned a moment or so ago that perhaps Scott Wagner didn't help his own cause by some of his remarks a couple of weeks ago. He talked about wanting to stomp on Tom Wolf's face with golf shoes. Remember those comments? That hurt him, I think, too.
Ridiculous, yeah. And of course, you know, he's been. They went after him for being as wealthy as he was. And any wealthy Republican should probably not mention the word golf. You know, if you're going to say something, say baseball spikes. You know, but Tom Wolf, of course, himself is a millionaire, too. But why play into those stereotypes? And it was just a vulgar comment, frankly, to say something like, he apologized the next day. The governor thanked him for the apology. He took the high ground on that one. The governor didn't criticize him for it. He just thanked him for the apology later. Mm-hmm. Again, it was on Facebook Live, which means it couldn't be edited since it was live.
Yeah,
that's one that will be used, no doubt, in campaign consulting circles for years to come and training seminars for candidates and their managers. Yeah, that was a big mistake he made.
Did Scott Wagner give up his state Senate seat in order to run for governor?
He resigned from that seat earlier this year. So, yeah, he did not keep.
So he's out of politics for at least the moment, eh?
Right.
Well, let's shift from the governor's race. As we said, a pretty decisive and really much larger victory for Democratic incumbent Tom Wolf than most people had imagined. And it was a pretty easy victory for Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator Bob Casey Jr. as well over Lou Barletta, the Republican challenger. Casey won that race by well over 600,000 votes.
Right. Again, the only surprise there was the level of winning margin. I thought that Casey clearly would win. I thought it would be single digits, but he actually went over that as well. So those were two races, frankly, that got very little national attention because the polling never had them close. The president did come in for Lou Barletta, but frankly, I think that was more as a favor since Barletta was his Pennsylvania campaign chair, one of the first members of Congress to support Donald Trump when he was running for president. So that was a different rule that was followed there, a favor as opposed to helping a candidate who's in a close race. He wasn't. That race, the polling never showed that close race.
Do you think Lou Barletta's adamant support for Trump hurt him, or is that really impossible to tell from this one race?
Well, it's impossible to tell. If this were an open seat, that might be an indication, but this was not. You have a two-term incumbent senator who you don't hear a lot from, but he also doesn't make big mistakes, doesn't make inappropriate comments. You don't hear a lot from Bob Casey. Pennsylvania really has sort of changed. When you think of the U.S. senators we've had in the past, pretty bombastic at times. National figures, of course, being Arlen Specter and Rick Santorum, and of course Ed Rendell. Tom Wolf is about as low key as Ed Rendell was bombastic. So it's a different era in Pennsylvania. Even Pat Toomey, terrific guy, just like Bob Casey, but very low key as well.
Yeah,
you don't
exactly
hear from them a lot. Very low-key candidates compared to what we've had in the past in Pennsylvania.
And they seem to get along pretty well, even though obviously they have philosophical differences on many issues. I'm not saying they're buddy-buddy, but they seem to get along pretty well.
Yeah, it's a brotherhood, a sisterhood, or however you should say it. You don't often see someone, a senator from the same state, go against his opponent. His colleague who's up for re-election. You didn't hear a lot. I watch a lot of this stuff. I don't recall seeing Pat Toomey out there campaigning against Bob Casey.
I didn't see any of that either.
That just really doesn't happen. You don't see that a whole lot in politics. And sometimes it might occur, but in most cases it does not.
We're talking with Doug Saltzman. For listeners who might be joining us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR in Butler, I'm Dave Mullarkey. Doug Saltzman is a political and a polling analyst. He is also a former top administrative aide to the late Senator Arlen Specter. Let's move on to Congress. Here in our listening area, Doug, we have now three congressional districts. Formerly we had just one, but the lines have been redrawn and they've been renumbered. And the closest race that we had of the three was Republican incumbent Mike Kelly fending off a challenge from Democrat Ron DiNicola. I don't know how closely you followed this race. Mike Kelly is from Butler. He was an overwhelming winner in Butler County, expected. Ron DiNicola is from Erie. He won Erie County. So what it was going to come down to was those three counties in the middle, Crawford, Mercer, and Lawrence. And Lawrence County numbers last night were very, very late in coming in. And DiNicola continued to maintain an edge. It was 4,000, it was 2,000. All of a sudden, the numbers came in from Lawrence County. It went heavily for Kelly. That tipped the scales, and Mike Kelly ended up winning another term. So he goes back to Washington for another two-year term. Not surprising. The polls that I saw right up until just a couple of days before the election predicted that this race would be one of the tightest ones, one of the tightest congressional races in Pennsylvania. Is that what you were seeing prior to Election Day?
No, absolutely. And I reviewed a lot of polls for that race, and I did follow it very closely. All the polls had them within the margin of error coming down to the wire. You mentioned about Lawrence County's numbers coming in very late, and they did. I even heard a national pundit on one of the national television networks mention how slow the numbers were coming in from this particular county in Pennsylvania for that race, because people were following that so very closely. You know, Mike Kelly, of course, it's always been sort of a Erie-based seat. The senator, the congressmen who represented that district over the years have been from Erie. Phil English, right after him, a one-term congresswoman was from Erie. Of course, Tom Ridge was from Erie. Mark Lincoln March before him was from Erie. So this is the first time in a long time that that congressional seat in the great northwest of Pennsylvania has been represented by somebody not from Erie County. Dahlkemper, I couldn't think of her name, the congresswoman who served one term.
Kathy Dahlkemper, defeated
Phil English and then was defeated by Mike Kelly. So it's different. He now was running against somebody from Erie County. And it was a very, very close race, as you mentioned.
Yes, and there were some tense moments in the Kelly camp because even though the margin was shrinking, DiNicola continued to lead, and then finally those big numbers came in from Lawrence County, and that tipped the scale. So Mike Kelly, a very popular figure here in Butler, as you might well imagine, and in Butler County, off to Washington again. Mike Kelly is a strong personality. He played football for Notre Dame after starring at Butler High School. He's extremely well-known, and he wins. A pretty tight race over Ron DiNicola. We have two other congressional districts here in Butler County. Glenn G.T. Thompson, a Republican incumbent, won handily over a Democratic challenger, Susan Bossier. That district now is a whopping geographical footprint. It goes from the eastern half of Butler County all the way out to Center County, State College, and all the way up to the New York line. It's big geographically because there aren't a whole lot of people in north-central Pennsylvania. Glenn Thompson, a Republican incumbent, he goes back for another term. And then there's that 17th district, Doug Saltzman. Let's talk about that one. There are only a handful of precincts in Butler County that are in that district. Handful of precincts in Cranberry Township. Mostly it's the North Hills of Pittsburgh and Beaver County. But it was, as I understand it, the only congressional race in the entire country that featured two incumbents going up against each other.
Exactly. And that's very rare for this time of year. For this season, usually those happen right after a redistricting situation where you have, seats as a result of the every 10-year census, they're getting merged together. But, of course, in Pennsylvania, we had that happen. It was court-ordered by the state Supreme Court, and the district really changed in Pennsylvania. So you had Connor Lamb, of course, who won by just 600 votes in the special election earlier this year in Congress for 6 months, taking on Keith Rothfuss, and won overwhelmingly. And it's not as if he inherited his the same district he ran in. He only had 25% of that district in the first time he ran in that special election earlier this year.
Mm-hmm. That would be, to me, the biggest surprise of the night for our immediate area. I was not surprised that Mike Kelly won re-election, and I expected it to be, you know, pretty much go down to the wire. I was quite surprised by the margin of victory for Connor Lamb over Keith Rothfuss. It was very decisive.
Yeah, I was surprised when I saw the polling on that from a number of sources doing analysis on them. That's what it was polling throughout, and I was always shocked. Usually, you know, you see one pull out of whack, you know, and you see other ones that are, but they were all giving him big, big victories. Again, his ultimate victory was larger than the polling had shown, but he literally became a national figure. And I know, talking to folks, that there were people coming from all over the country to support his special election campaign and this one as well. He really became a darling of the left. And it became almost a national figure. He was a national figure during that special election just 6 months ago. Some at this point, you recall the president came in for Rick Scatone, the state representative who actually ran against him in that race. And the president was heard thinking he was off mic saying that Rick Scatone was a weak candidate.
Yes.
although he got within 600 votes of winning that race. And, of course, the person he beat to run in that seat was a state senator named Guy Reschenthaler, who actually won a congressional seat yesterday and a reconfigured seat. So he's now in Congress and the fellow. And again, of course, remember that in those special elections, there's no primary. The party apparatus picks the candidates from both parties.
Mm-hmm.
They pick Scatone over Reschenthaler. And now looking back on that, some folks believe Reschenthaler may have beat Scatone and all this would have been used. But that's politics, isn't it?
Water over the dam, yeah. Connor Lamb, and I too am intrigued that he's become a national figure so quickly. He's young, he's an attractive candidate. That's kind of superficial, but that counts a lot these days in terms of TV ads. He's a Marine veteran. They're pretty attractive candidate. Let's move on to state house races. All members of the state house were up for election. All seats were up for election. Here in Butler County, Doug, we have Butler County has really been carved up in the latest drawing of the boundaries. We have now seven different individuals who represent parts of Butler County in the state house. Seven. There are only two districts that are totally within Butler County. The other five, you know, extend into neighboring counties. But there were no surprises here. All of the seats are currently held by Republicans. They are all incumbents. They were all seeking re-election. And not only did they all win, they all won very handily. And the Republicans maintained control of the state house. Although I understand the Democrats did make some inroads there. Am I correct on that?
They did, yeah. They picked up a couple, but they're so far behind and so far in the minority, they would have to have an incredible swing to be able to get back into the majority. But Tom Wolf is still going to have a very, very Republican state house and state senate to deal with in this race. But you're right. For the population size of Butler County, I believe they have more state representatives per person as for the county as a whole than any other county in Pennsylvania. That's one of those stats someone once told to me, and I haven't taken time actually to check into it. But for the population of Butler County to have seven different state representatives representing it is very unique.
Yeah, we have Ted Nesbitt, who's reelected to a third term, Aaron Bernstein to a second term, Brian Ellis, an eighth term now, eighth consecutive term, Daryl Metcalf, staunch conservative, well-known throughout the state. He's been in that office in the 12th District since 1998. He won easily yesterday. Also, James Marshall, Jeff Pyle, and R. Lee James, all representing at least a portion of Butler County in the State House, and all easy winners yesterday. Let's talk about go ahead, please. Go ahead.
Depending how you look at it, that's not bad when your county has a lot of folks looking out for it in the state General Assembly. Some think that it's better just to have one or two that can completely focus on it. But I don't think it's all that bad, frankly, to have other folks on your behalf of your county. You just have to remind them, even if they're not from Butler County, and some of those folks are not, they still represent the county and can represent them well in Harrisburg.
Let's talk about the national scene. Doug Saltzman, we're chatting with Doug, kind of a post-election recap here, post-election analysis. In the U.S. Congress, the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., Democrats, the latest numbers I saw, picked up at least 26 seats. Still a couple that are a little too close to call, I guess. But it does give Democrats control of the House. They take back control of the House, although in the Senate, the Republicans picked up at least two seats, so they strengthened their grasp on the Senate. I've seen both sides claiming victory. Did they both win? what happened there?
Well, I never believe in moral victory. You know, if you lose, you lose. But the Democrats clearly thought, and most pundits thought, they would pick up more than 26 seats, which it is right now. That could increase. But when you compare that to previous numbers, you know, they in 2014, the Democrats lost 13 seats in Congress. In 2010, they lost an incredible 63 seats in a midterm in Congress. In 2006, they did capture seats that time. But you take a look at some of these years. In 1994, the first midterm election for Bill Clinton, the Democrats lost 54. I mean, that's an incredible number of seats to lose in a midterm election. And just 4 years later, the change continues in that route, where you have midterm elections that simply do not go well for the incumbent president of the opposite party. There's only been, and it's hard to believe, since 1890, there's only been three midterm elections where the president's party has picked up seats in the House. Only three times since 1890. You have to go all the way back to 1934 with Roosevelt, and then, of course, there were two recently, Bill Clinton's second midterm election and George Bush the Younger's first midterm election. But it's not unusual, as I mentioned, for the party opposite of the president to pick up seats in the U.S. House in midterm elections.
So what does this all mean? Let's first talk about the U.S. House, House of Representatives, where the Democrats are now in control. I've seen analysts on the national scene who seem to indicate that the Democrats will try to force President Trump to release his tax returns. Of course, as we know, he said 2 years ago that he was under audit and he would release those very soon.
And in fact, in the news conference he did today, he was asked that question, as you might imagine. He said, it's still under audit, and I will not consider releasing it until the audit's done.
Well, that's
I think my tax returns are complicated. I'm sure he could fill a gymnasium, for heaven's sake, the size of a Donald Trump tax return, let alone the audit, looking into it.
Well, we'll see how that shakes down.
Ed Rendell last night on a national program, national news program, was interviewed and said, well, the Democrats have won the House. He said, now, make sure you don't just investigate, also legislate, which was a pretty blunt comment by Ed Rendell to make, saying, you know, there's more to getting the majority than just investigating the Trump administration. And he made it very clear they need to do more than just. And so that's a good catchphrase that you're going to hear probably over and over. And he's been quoted several times today saying, don't just investigate, legislate. Mm-hmm. So we'll wait and see if he takes that advice. The question is whether Nancy Pelosi will continue as Speaker. There's been calls for her to move on. She's indicated that she might be willing to be a transitional leader, which means I'll stick around for a little bit and find somebody else I'm happy with to replace me now as Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Don't you think it's time for her to move on?
Well, she's been here a long, long time. She's not had a whole lot of success. In fact, she's had horrific losses during her time as leader of the Democrats, whether in the minority or in the majority as Speaker. Even Conor Lamb, when he was running in a special election 6 months ago, said he would not support Nancy Pelosi and would not vote for her for Speaker. Again, they won majority. That was their goal. But I think most Democrats were hoping for a 50-seat pickup, and they got about half of that. So, the majority is the majority. You're running the show. But I think they wanted a much stronger majority than they got.
Don't you think Nancy Pelosi carries an awful lot of negative baggage, kind of analogous to Hillary Clinton 2 years ago? Democratic leadership obviously didn't realize the effect that her negative baggage is going to have in the election. I think you could make the same comments about Nancy Pelosi.
No, I agree. No, absolutely. And we did an analysis, I think it's now 4 years ago, on polling that was done around the nation. And it was determined that there were less than 20 of the 435 congressional seats in America that would vote for Nancy Pelosi for their own congressman. Or congressperson, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So that is an overwhelming negative against someone who's leading a national party. And again, indicating that she's not well-liked across America. And in fact, they used that heavily in that special election against Connor Lamb. I didn't see that used this time in this race against Connor Lamb by Keith Rothfuss, but it was used millions and millions of dollars for connecting Connor Lamb to Nancy Pelosi in that special election.
I saw one pundit late last night, maybe it was even early this morning, I'm not sure, on national TV.
You lose track.
Yeah, you do, you do. They were talking about, whether or not it was a blue wave, and most everybody that I saw indicated, well, no. I mean, the Democrats did take control of the House back, but it wasn't a tsunami. However, I heard one commentators say, well, it wasn't a blue wave, but it was a pink wave, because there are many more women who are going to be in the U.S. Congress now than before after yesterday's election results. We're talking about all over the country now, and even here in Pennsylvania. I think there were four or five women elected to Congress yesterday.
Yeah, we currently have no women in Congress in Pennsylvania's 18 seats. We now have four when they're sworn in January. Which, whether you agree with a candidate or not, I think that's a good thing. There aren't enough women in politics. Maybe that's because I'm a father of four daughters. But it was an absolute wave for women in this election year. How many ran? Almost had America's first African American woman governor from Georgia. She's not conceded yet. She's pushing for a recall. I don't think that will happen there. But she came very close. And, of course, she was the cause celeb. My gosh, Oprah Winfrey came in campaigned for her in Georgia, among other celebrities. There definitely was a pink wave, I guess is one way to put it. But in terms of a blue wave, the Democrats would have had to won the Senate for that to occur and had to won bigger, more seats in the House to call it a wave, whatever a wave is, right? No, I wouldn't call it a blue wave at all.
Well, let's talk about the Senate. Republicans already had tenuous control of the Senate. They picked up at least two seats yesterday. So what does that mean? Well, first of all, it should mean much easier confirmation votes, should it not, for any Trump judicial appointments or cabinet nominees?
Yeah, I would think. And some of Donald Trump's strongest opponents, Jeff Flake, of course, did not run for re-election. And, of course, we lost the legendary John McCain, who at times was against the president, of course. That should make it easier for the president to get some of his nominees through, whether or not he gets another member of the Supreme Court between now and re-election. I would think the liberals on the U.S. Supreme Court will do everything they can to hold those seats, at least until after the next presidential election, which, by the way, I think we got about a 12-hour break. So later tonight, I think the presidential race starts for 2020.
Well, Trump has already started re-election mechanisms, campaign and so on and so forth. So obviously,
yes, it's to the point anymore where it's an incorporated corporation that runs presidential campaigns. And in the days when President Reagan made an announcement, I decided to run for re-election. Not nowadays. That's generally no surprise that president's going to run for re-election. In fact, except for Lyndon Johnson, I don't recall the last time an incumbent president who could run for re-election chose not to. It just doesn't happen.
I'd like to see the acronym that President Trump comes up with for his reelection committee. He would have to go a long way to beat the incredible one for Richard Nixon, if you'll recall. It was CREEP.
CREEP.
Committee for the Reelection of the President. CREEP.
In fact, I was talking about that last night. CREEP. In fact, my old boss, Arlen Specter, at one point was called the CREEP Chief because he was heading it up in Pennsylvania for Nixon's reelection in 1972. Hmm. So, I don't think he'll come up with CREEP again.
I don't think that'll fly.
I would hope not.
No,
yeah.
I don't think so either. We have another census coming up shortly now. We're almost to 2019. There'll be another census in 2020. Now, the lines, the political borders are not redrawn immediately after a census. There's a time that, you know, you have to tabulate the results and make sure everything is on the up and up. It usually takes about a year before new boundaries are established. Do you think that these recently redrawn and renumbered congressional districts in Pennsylvania will be redrawn rather drastically again, Doug Saltzman?
Well, I think the Republicans learned that since the state Supreme Court is so overwhelmingly Democrat at this point, they realized they may not be able to gerrymander them as they did the last time around. And if you saw those old gerrymandered seats in Pennsylvania, they were incredible. At one point, a seat in the eastern part of the state at one section got as narrow as a restaurant and then expanded out into another part of the district.
Yeah.
So I don't think you're going to see that again because they know that Democrats would immediately challenge that and likely would win again. Again, the next races that would be affected by the census and the redistricting would likely be 2022 because mm-hmm. obviously they can't do it for the 2020 race. That's the exact same time they're doing the census. But generally it kicks in the very next election year. And, of course, everything is redistricted as a result of a census. The U.S. House seats, the state House seats, the state Senate seats, even municipal seats, if they're by district, at times get redistricted because of population shifts. Pennsylvania was losing population for years. It's no longer losing population, but at the same time, we're not growing as quick as other states are, Texas, Arizona, California, Florida. So whether we lose a seat or not is still to be determined, but we have lost at least two seats in the last four redistrictings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're down to 18 members of Congress now. Still a big player in terms of, still one of the most important states, but definitely down from what we had a couple of decades ago. Well, I'm not quite sure that I'm ready to think about the census yet in 2020. I remember all the controversy about that the last time, and I'm sure there will be this time. Both sides, and I'm talking about the national political party chairs, have claimed a victory in the midterms yesterday. Would it be possible to say that in a way they're both right, Doug Saltzman?
Well, I think that the Democrats are probably more right, considering they won control of the U.S. House of Representatives. That's quite a victory. The Republicans increased their hold on the U.S. Senate, so that's their victory. The Democrats did not win as many seats as some had hoped or some had predicted, so I suppose that's one of those moral victories for the Republicans. But if you were to say someone won yesterday, you'd have to say that the Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives were the big winners yesterday because they are taking back the majority control of the lower chamber in Washington.
Mm-hmm. And statewide, just to wrap up our conversation here, that same general question, I think you can say depending on how you look at it, a split. Obviously, two Democrats winning at the top of the ticket there, Governor Tom Wolf and Senator Bob Casey. But on the other hand, Republicans remained firmly in control of both houses of the state legislature in Harrisburg.
Absolutely. However, just 6 months ago, there were 13 Republican congressmen from Pennsylvania and 5 Democrats. That's now split. So the big wins there. For Democrats in terms of the U.S. House members from the state of Pennsylvania.
What did you hear about percentage of voter turnout in Pennsylvania. The only numbers that I have are here in Butler County, and we had almost exactly 50% of the registered voters who went to the polls yesterday here in Butler County, 50%. And, of course, that's just 50% of the registered voters. Not everybody is registered to vote.
Exactly. And I say that all the time. And when people, oh, look, it hit 50%. I'm like, well, first off, that's horrible. You know, only 50% of people who are registered to vote bother to vote. And you have to keep in mind, only about two-thirds of people bother to register to vote. So we're talking a small percentage of Americans came out to vote yesterday. And that's disappointing. I have not seen the final numbers yet for Pennsylvania and the total voters, how many showed up. But it was around that number, significant, for a midterm election. But I hate to think of it as historic when still, you know, the majority of Pennsylvanians and Americans don't vote. The ones who can vote don't. So I don't get too excited, and it's so disappointing when you hear those numbers about over half of America chooses not to vote. I don't understand it. It's not real hard to vote, Dave, no. As you well know. In America, you don't have to dodge bullets and risk your life to get to a polling spot as you do in some other countries who might be newly democratic in their voting system. It is so frustrating. You can hear my voice getting loud. It really bothers me.
People don't bother to vote.
It
took about a minute to vote yesterday. It was a very short ballot. One final comment, and I'm waiting to see these numbers. I haven't seen anything on this yet. There might not be for a few days. But in my particular polling place, when I voted yesterday, and I voted in the late afternoon, one of the poll workers said, you know what, numbers are up greatly from the spring primary. And she said, and we're seeing many, many more young people. Many more millennials. I'll be anxious to see statistics on that when they come out in a few days, both statewide and nationwide. Did, in fact, more young people go to the polls yesterday? That would be an interesting statistic.
It would be. And what also was significant, 40 million Americans voted early in this election year. We don't have that choice in Pennsylvania. But overwhelming early voting. Nothing has come close to this year's early voting. And, of course, most of them are younger people.
Mm-hmm.
Who choose to do it that way. But that was also a significant event yesterday. A couple other little quirky things, and a lot of people probably forgot, if you're not from Utah, that Mitt Romney got elected to the U.S. Senate yesterday. And, of course, former presidential candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And not too often you hear a former governor of Massachusetts winning a Senate seat in Utah. We all know the name Pence, of course, the vice president. Here's another little quirk from yesterday's election. His older brother won a seat in the House. I don't know how I could look into that to see if we've ever before had a vice president who had a sibling in Congress. So I don't know.
Very interesting.
That was one of those little funny things from yesterday as well.
Doug Saltzman, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and we appreciate your analysis this day after election. Doug Saltzman is a political and polling analyst. He's been our guest here on It's Your Turn today. Thanks, Doug. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Have a good day.
Sure. You too. So long. Doug Saltzman, former top administrative aide to the late Arlen Specter, was one of Pennsylvania's U.S. senators for many, 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 many years. We'll take a break. When we come back, we have more coming up on the It's Your Turn program today. Let's take a quick break, though. One of our sponsors on the program, just a second here until I get my papers straight, put my Doug Saltzman papers aside there. Okay, here we go. A quick break and back with more on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. One of our other sponsors on the program today is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. Hey, folks, if you're cleaning house for the holidays and you realize how close the holidays are, 2 weeks from tomorrow is Thanksgiving Day. If you're cleaning up, maybe cleaning out the spare bedroom for the arrival of guests, or maybe just cleaning out the hall closet or the attic, and you come up with items that you no longer need or want, consider donating, please, to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store in the Greater Butler Mart, Route 8 South. They welcome donations of clothing and shoes and furniture and household items. Here's the thing. Money generated from the sale of items at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store stays in Butler County. Every penny of it stays here, and it helps to support the food bank and the client aid program of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. They're open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., 6 days a week, and they're conveniently located in the Greater Butler Mart, Route 8, just south of Butler. There's plenty of free parking right outside the door. Their drop-off bins are right inside the door. Very, very easy. And remember, if you have big stuff like furniture, dining room set, bedroom set, whatever, or a bunch of items, call them and they'll come pick it up in the truck. Phone number is 287-8682. They like to say we stand tallest when we stoop to help others. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul in Butler. One more quick message, and then we're going to be talking with Ashley Brown, who has penned a most interesting book. Ashley Brown and her husband decided that they were not going to have children. And then she began to wonder about that. A complex decision. She called it a gut-wrenching decision. And she writes about it. And we'll talk to her about that in just a moment.
I can't remember the last time I went to the dentist. Now I'm too embarrassed to go because my teeth are in such bad condition.
Unfortunately, this person is not alone. Many folks put off going to the dentist because they fear being scolded for neglecting their teeth. This is Dr. Bob Todd with a special message. Dentistry today is faster, easier, and better than ever before. At our dental office, we don't believe in making you feel guilty, no matter how long it has been since you've seen a dentist. We know fear and embarrassment can cause a cycle of procrastination. If it has been years since you've been to the dentist, call us today. We will help put your mind at ease and bring your smile back to health.
If you hate going to the dentist but know you have a dental problem, help is only a phone call away. Dr. Bob Todd and his friendly dental team will answer all your questions and care for all your concerns. For complimentary information or to schedule an appointment at their Butler office on Evan City Road, please call 282-7774 or on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Going to be talking on the next segment, listeners. If it's your turn here on WISR, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest joins us by telephone. She is Ashley Brown, author of Letters to the Daughter I'll Never Have. Ashley, nice to meet you. Thanks for being with us for a few minutes here today.
Thank you so much. I look forward to chatting with you.
And I as well. This is an interesting book. It's kind of a memoir. After your decision, the decision of you and your husband to opt out of parenthood, you decided you didn't want to have children, and so you've written this book. It's a series of letters, right?
It is. It is what it sounds like. They are letters written directly to this imaginary daughter as she moves through her life.
So are you free to tell why you and your husband decided to opt out of parenthood?
Yeah, I am. And I'm not shy about it. In the book, there are so many reasons, pros and cons, and that's really why I sat down to do this project. I'm a very indecisive person about the smallest things and the biggest things, and this was not easy for us to land on for either one of us. And my husband actually does have a daughter. She's grown now. So he has gotten to have the experience of parenting. So we came at it from two different angles. So there's part of me that was making this particular decision alone because I'm, again, coming at it from my own experience or lack thereof. And so our reasons, though, even though we're coming at it from two different life experiences, are pretty much the same. A lot of it has to do with the fear of what we can't control and not being sort of recognizing that it might be irresponsible to bring a child into a home when we may not have the finances to care for that child should trouble arise. we may not have the temperaments to deal with certain kinds of parenting challenges. It may put strain on our relationship that we don't want to experience ourselves nor put a child through. And also just the state of the planet, that there's a lot to care for already. We feel like we have a lot of nurturing to do and a lot of love to give for life that's already here. And, you know, we question, is the state of the world safe enough to, you know, to want to continue to bring more life into it versus caring for the life that's here. So I'll stop there. That's a lot. but you can tell we had a lot of discussions, and it's not been simple.
Yeah. In fact, you referred to it as gut-wrenching, this decision. But you also say that in this book, you take readers on the journey to reconcile two opposite emotions, both grief about deciding to have any children, and also relief. Can you talk about that a little bit, grief and relief?
Yeah, and I think that is part of the coming to terms with or peace with a decision for me, is accepting that you don't have to feel all happy about it. And so that's why this process was so cathartic for me and helpful for me to recognize it's okay that there are things that I'm going to be really sad that I'm missing out on. And it's okay to celebrate all the things I'm not going to have to go through, and the choices that I am making. And so, you know, the grief and relief meeting, again, to me, it's just kind of a beautiful recognition of most of life's experience, that even choosing to be a parent, and I have a great therapist who helped me sort of understand this a long time ago when I was talking with him about the decision. He's a parent of three beautiful children, and he said, you know, not enough parents recognize they also they have to mourn what they did not choose and the life they're not having because they have children, and not enough seem to do that. You know, they feel like it's all supposed to be, you know, nothing but celebration. I'm so happy I'm a parent. Of course, that, you know, plenty of people recognize the stress, but they don't necessarily go through a mourning process. And so yeah, it's this book really is, it's half and half of, like you said, gut-wrenching, you know, heartbreaking realizations of what I will never be able to do and share as a mother, and just as much expressing my relief of the incredibly difficult decisions I won't have to make for my child, the things I'm not going to have to stress over, the things she won't have to go through. and so yeah, it's all both, and all the discussions I've had with my family, my mom, my dad, my in-laws, they all feel the same. It's, we can be sad for 5 minutes while we talk about it, and then assured we're making the right decision and happy about it for the next 5 minutes.
Ashley Brown, listeners, is a lifelong educator, freelance writer, editor. She's a professor for the University of Oklahoma, teaching distance learning courses. You do note in your book, Letters to the Daughter I'll Never Have, that even though the path that you and your husband have chosen not to have children, it still doesn't mean that you can't care for the life that already exists all around us, whether or not you're a parent, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's sort of my first response, when luckily I have not been one of those people who's been subjected to it. I've heard stories of, you know, strangers or acquaintances kind of challenging one's very personal decision to have children or not. And like, it's like there's something wrong with you if you, you know, don't want to have that experience or lead that particular life. And again, I haven't really been subject to that. But, you know, when it does come up, sort of, why explain to us on behalf of every person, you know, why you would not want to have a child. Part of the thing my husband and I agree on most is there's just so much to care for already. And if some people don't make the decision not to keep adding to the population with their own, you know, nuclear family, we might not have enough energy and love and nurturing to give, you know, what is already here. You know, maybe we need some people who are okay loving the, you know, the earth, the children, the animals, our family that we do have, you know, people who are in need, you know, can it be just as fulfilling in a different kind of way to direct your, you know, ability to nurture and your ability to care and love and give to all that that's already here.
Where did you ever get the idea? It's fascinating. Where did you ever get the idea to write to an imaginary child?
It struck me that that was the only way I was going to be able to really come to this decision. And so, to be honest, when I started the project for myself, I wasn't 100% sure it would be never. So really writing the book was, it just, again, it struck me, I have to talk to her. That's the only way. I have to be a parent in my imagination and really sit with, again, all of the reasons I'm not, talk to her. You know, I don't know. It really did. It was a lightning bolt one day of, if I'm going to figure this out, I need to talk to her. And so every time I would sit down to write, you know, I truly only had her in mind, and there was something very beautiful about that, and sort of soothing. And no, you know, I didn't think about anybody else reading. Just having that really intimate discussion with her was what I needed to do to land at the end of the book. Am I really, you know, am I okay with never? And in talking with her and writing to her, I decided that I am.
What types of things did you write to this imaginary daughter about? And did you imagine her at the same age in all of these letters?
No. So I started out as she was a baby, and I pretty much moved through her life, not every moment of it, obviously, or every year. But yeah, so the first letters have a slightly different tone because I am imagining I'm talking to a very little girl. Sometimes I would even imagine myself as a child and who I was and the types of things I would have wanted and needed to hear. And that I did hear. I had wonderful parents, by the way, who gave me an awesome childhood. They start again kind of a little lighter. You know, I don't want to be too harsh with my with my little girl, or too realistic in some ways. And then I move through her growing up, her teenage years, into her adult years. Towards the end of the book, I write a letter to her about whether or not she would want to have children, and talk to her, you know, woman to woman about making that decision. I do write to her a lot about what it is to be a girl and a woman, the beauty of it and the challenges of it and in today's world and for always. I write to her about, similarly, a lot of the values that are important to me that I would want to pass along to her. And that's where kind of the memoir part comes in. I realized I needed to tell my own stories of how I came to be who I am and believe what I believe so that I could explain to her and share my principles. I tell her a lot of stories about, again, my own growing up, my own teenage, you know, I talk to her about drugs and sex and the decisions I made and what kind of trouble she's going to get into or not get into. I talk to her about how to educate her and what kind of schools she should go to. So it's a mixture. And I also talk to her about why I'm glad, you know, again, the challenges that I'm glad I'm not going to be inviting into my life. So, I tell her about the difficulties of raising children with just the internet and the iPhones and how I can't imagine doing that. And so, you know, it's sort of my apology. So, sorry, I'm going to choose not to because it seems really overwhelming. So it's all of it.
Did these letters come easy for you to write? What was the hardest one, the hardest letter you had to write to this imaginary daughter?
The hardest letter was probably the first. When I explained to her, even and there again, I'm still imagining her as a baby that I'm choosing not to bring into the world, and so I explaining to her, trying to sum up in one letter, just like you can tell, I might have difficulty, you know, summing it up as talking points when I speak with other people. It was very challenging that first one to try to say, but I needed to do it in order to kind of begin the process. But that took a long time, and it was not easy to tell her in a nutshell why she's the daughter I'll never have. So those bigger ones were the harder ones, trying to cover a lot of, you know, emotional territory with her and in a short space. Those were challenging, but for the most part, absolutely enjoyed the process, you know, and I loved, again, some of the lighter ones and sharing stories with her. And it was, yeah, every time I sat down to write, I got totally lost in it, which I know is a good sign. You're supposed to follow those moments. So I knew it was, you know, I knew it was what I was supposed to be doing.
We're talking to Ashley Brown, author of Letters to the Daughter I'll Never Have. Did you visually imagine this daughter? Imagine what she would look like?
That was a little too hard for me. I wonder, and I write to her about that. That's a sadness to me, again, just wondering how, you know, what a child created by my husband and I and me would look like. There's no way I could fathom that. And so, again, that's part of the grief for me, is that I'll never know what that looks like. So when I imagined her, she was more of an entity. And I would say, if anything, again, I pictured myself. You know, I think we all do that, even as parents, sort of, as, you know, we're kind of not living vicariously through our children. But my mom certainly, you know, only she wanted me to be a very feminine, you know, ballerina type like she had been. And I was not. I was very much a tomboy. And so I picture my daughter like I, you know, essentially who I was, which again made it pretty easy. And I know that the chances of that turning out that way, were she real, would be pretty slim.
Do you, I'm sure you had to think as you were developing the this book and the whole process, and as you wrote it, you had to think about parents who would long to have children but were unable to for any variety of reasons. Do you think your book might resonate with them?
I hope so. I hope, you know, and I've heard from parents that this book has resonated with them. You know, I hope that what comes through is that, again, it's a book about love and family, and however that family has to be or is chosen to be. And so I hope in that sense it resonates with a variety of people. I do have a special place in my heart and sympathy for those who desperately want to be parents and can't. And I have close friends in my life who have been through that path. And yes, again, if anything, I hope that this would be again, sort of a therapeutic, a way to commiserate, no matter where, you know, how we've landed in this and where we are in life, to find understanding and empathy with one another, rather than to, you know, judge or say, because you're experiencing, you know, how could you choose not to when I've been forced not to? And, you know, I see no reason to, again, compare and contrast and judge each other's experiences like that. I would hope that instead, yeah, we can commiserate and lift one another up and find the common bonds in our experience.
Do you think your decision in any way relates to women's issues today? I mean, it wouldn't have been that long ago, a generation or two ago, and in many cases, fairly or unfairly, a lot of women were judged, you know, their importance, their value was determined on how many kids they had. Not necessarily the case today, but that would not have been the case a generation or two ago. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think that's only changed, and I think that's currently changing and has only started to change very recently. And so I feel, I guess we should all feel lucky to an extent that I think that the conversation is much more common. I think that's hard still for a lot of women to understand that it can be a conversation. It can be something you really put a lot of thought into either way. And I would hope that it is. But yeah, I have, you know, I'm 39 and have a lot of friends who, you know, in their 20s didn't really give that much, you know, they married the person that they were in love with in college and married right out of college and had the family early on. And they'll tell me now, I didn't really think about doing anything else because that's just sort of, that's what you do. That's the example that's been set for us. And so I think, it's only pretty recently that young women and men are giving it more thought, maybe taking things a little more slowly in terms of the big decisions like that, marriage and children and all of the stuff, and thinking about all the different ways that we can have fulfilling lives and opening our minds to, you know, different, and again, having the freedom societally, sort of, and culturally to think about different choices.
Let me close our time together, Ashley Brown, with a quote from a testimonial that you got on your book from Beth Wood, a singer-songwriter, winner of the Kerrville Folk Festival, by the way, which is one of my favorite folk festivals. Beth Wood said this, and I'm just partially quoting from her testimonial, talking about your book. She called it a heart-opening wonder, a meditation on family, real life, marriage, friendship, and the sometimes bittersweet truth of a road not taken. That's a nice testimonial, isn't it?
It's beautiful. Yeah. I'm grateful for it and grateful for her read of it.
The title is Letters to the Daughter I'll Never Have by Ashley Brown. She's been our guest for the past few minutes here on It's Your Turn on WISR. Nice to meet you, Ashley. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Have a good day now.
You too.
It's that time of the year. Sniffles, coughing, chills, everything else that comes with cold and flu season. At Institute Hill Pharmacy, they want to get you feeling better as soon as possible. You'll have your prescription filled in minutes and be on your way to feeling better. Because who wants to be sick around the holidays? Stop by Institute Hill Pharmacy at 937 East Jefferson Street. Call 285-3693 or find them on Facebook. And don't forget, they have great 99-cent greeting cards, retailer gift cards, and seasonal gifts for the holidays. Institute Hill Pharmacy, and old fashioned pharmacy just the way you remember.
Come back, folks. We move into the final segment of our It's Your Turn program today. We're very pleased to once again be able to talk with Penn State Extension educator Maria Graziani. Maria, good to talk with you again. Glad you could be with us today.
Hi, thank you. I'm glad to be here and to speak with you and to let the public know about what we're doing at Extension.
Maria is part of a team, the Energy, Business, and Community Vitality Team of Penn State Extension. And that's a new title, a new name for the team, right, Maria?
It's a new name, though we're still doing the same thing. We've got our energy educators who work along the lines of shale and energy in western Pennsylvania, well, across the state. And then our team of economic and community development educators. And then we have team members who do it. Specifically what I do, which is agricultural entrepreneurship, business management, and farm financial management.
Well, we're going to talk about beer, first of all, with Maria.
It's a great topic.
I have to tell you, our initial guest today was a political and polling analyst, Doug Saltzman, and we were reviewing yesterday's midterm elections, both locally and nationwide. In the midst of my conversation with Doug, I mentioned that we were going to be talking with you about beer later on the program, and he said, I could use one of those after last night's election returns.
Always a good way to celebrate, and with the growing market in Pennsylvania, there's plenty of beer to go around.
I knew that the craft brewing business was expanding rapidly only because of here in Butler County. My goodness, we've got even just recently, 7 or 8 new craft breweries that have sprung up, 2 of them right within the city of Butler and others in nearby outlying areas. But I guess this is exploding all over Pennsylvania, these craft breweries, right?
All over Pennsylvania. So there are over 300 craft breweries, and craft is defined as a brewery that produces less than 6 million barrels of beer annually and is majority owned by their particular brewing organization and not by a larger cooperative organization.
Mm-hmm.
An organization, for instance, like Anheuser-Busch owns multiple breweries, but yeah, the brewery has to have majority ownership. And specifically, we're working with microbreweries, and those are breweries that produce less than 6,000 barrels annually. There's about 293 microbreweries alone in Pennsylvania. So probably those are the breweries that we mostly see in our communities popping up. So small brew pubs, they mostly produce and sell locally. They come up with all types of varieties of unique styles of beers.
So does that number surprise you, listeners? It certainly did me until I was reviewing some of the background material that Maria sent to me. Nearly 300 so-called microbreweries have popped up across Pennsylvania. So, okay, we know that, and we say, gosh, is that many? That's great. What really hasn't been explored is the potential for Pennsylvania farmers to be part of the supply chain for all of these micro breweries and these craft breweries, right?
That is exactly right. So we've got a growing market. In fact, despite the brewery numbers, or in conjunction with the brewery numbers, Pennsylvania ranks currently number one in the production of craft beer, meaning we produce the most amount of barrels across the nation. So we're first in line with the amount of beer we produce, which means our brewers are buying a lot of agricultural inputs to produce their beer. And if you're familiar with beer making it all, those agricultural inputs include hops, barley, malted barley in particular, also fruits, grain, other grains like wheat and rye, all can go into beer production. So we've got a pretty big demand from agriculture coming from the brewers. And as they increase their production, the existing breweries, and as new breweries pop up, that means there's more demand for those products.
Well, Penn State Extension decided last year to conduct research assessing both the current and the future production levels and the supply chain people to identify future potential for local and regional sourcing of these ingredients. And there were some key findings from this research that was conducted last year, one of which, and perhaps most importantly, Maria Graziani, was the fact that few businesses are buying locally or regionally so many of these ingredients that they need to make beer.
It is true, and we found out from those findings not because of want of the brewers. The brewers would like to buy locally. They would be excited to be able to market their beer as locally made with local ingredients, majority local ingredients. Where we're falling short in agriculture is that we do not have a large enough amount of farmers producing for that industry. So even though we have a significant amount of barley farmers in the state of Pennsylvania, they're not producing barley for malting, which is a very high quality barley that requires a lot of care and attention. It has to be free of molds and funguses on the plant so that when it comes into the malting house, it will not introduce bacteria and molds to the grain. So it is a different level of production. And on that other side, we do not have a lot of malting houses in the state of Pennsylvania that would accept local barley for malting. We do have a couple of ones growing, like CNC Malting is close by. It's over in Mercer County. And we've got three other malting houses more in the central and eastern part of Pennsylvania. But we would like to see, and part of our research will hopefully assist those malting houses in being able to bring in more grain for malting so that brewers can buy malted barley locally in Pennsylvania. So there are a lot of things along the value chain of beer production that we have to work on to get our farmers to be able to produce.
I like beer, but I don't know very much about, how to prepare the ingredients. Well, do you know anything? How do you malt barley? Do you know what that means?
Malting barley is actually, I don't want to call it a simple process. I do not want to oversimplify it, but it's really re-sprouting the grain. And when you sprout the grain, so it comes off the field and it's re-sprouted, the seed basically head is re-sprouted. And when it does that, it releases sugar. Mm. Right as it begins to sprout, the maltster then dries the barley, almost roasting it. And it can be roasted from light to dark, and that would produce a particular style of beer. So it's going to have a certain amount of sugars in that sprouting process. And then in the roasting and drying, it's going to basically capture that sugar. Go ahead.
What are some of the other key findings of this research that the university did, that Penn State did last year? I would guess that one key thing would be to start trying to build relationships between the brewers and the farmers.
That is what we're working on right now, and that's really exciting. It's actually kind of fun to get farmers and brewers and maltsters and processors in the same room talking about what they want and need in order to grow the industry. Hops, which is essential to beer making, is an expensive crop to put in. It's got initial upfront costs, and hop farmers really want to create the type of hops that brewers demand. But getting them in the room to discuss all of this, to get to know each other, one, it can really help a farmer understand the industry better and hear firsthand.
Are you still there?
Yep, I'm here. Can
okay.
you hear me?
Yeah, we had a little drop out there. I was afraid we lost you, but we've got you. That's good.
great. So, you know, a farmer can ask the brewer in these focus groups and in these sessions all about their business and what they would want from the farmer, which can really help a farmer continue to process, do I want to jump into this industry? And what we're looking at right now is just seeing if we can get, you know, a dozen or so farmers, particularly right now in western Pennsylvania, to be interested in growing hops or barley for malting. And if we can get a group of them interested, then we're going to facilitate some opportunities for them. So can we get farmers to put in even just 1 or 2 acres to start experimenting with hops? We'll help facilitate relationships with the brewers and work on contract negotiations with them, and we'll work on the details of the style of crop and what time of year it's harvested and what are the price points the brewers are looking at. So these are all the things that Penn State Extension educators can assist farmers with so that they feel like they're making a good choice to transition.
Some farmers might be a little hesitant to jump into this area if they're not sure about future growth. Obviously, the numbers are pretty surprising right now, close to 300 microbreweries in Pennsylvania, more craft breweries. Did the Penn State's study indicate anything about projections for still further growth?
Well, right now we're looking at an expected growth of, I'm looking at some numbers in front of me, 500 barrels of beer in the past year, and by 2020, 82% of the breweries are expected to produce even more. That's a 70% increase in production from where we're at. So the majority of the breweries that we polled expect a 70% increase in production. So what we asked them specifically is how they were planning on selling. Are they distributing to bars and restaurants? Are they canning and bottling beers and sending those off to beer distributors across the state? Are they crossing state lines in the near future and producing regionally? So most of them look to significantly double and triple and quadruple the amount they produce in the next 3 to 5 years. And this is on par with national statistics as well, that we're still, beer production across the nation is on the rise. It's not reached its peak yet, and that's good for farmers.
We're talking with Maria Graziani, a Penn State Extension educator, about the potential. And as you can hear from her remarks, it sounds like a pretty good potential for farmers locally and regionally to get involved in growing more crops that would supply the supply chain for these mushrooming number of craft breweries and microbreweries. I was surprised as I looked over the Penn State survey, Maria, to note that, first of all, there's only a few counties that don't have any fermented beverage businesses. I mentioned Butler County has several now, close to a dozen that have sprung up in the last few years. But two of the counties that do not have any are neighboring counties, Armstrong and Venango. No fermented beverage businesses there.
And this research study is from 2017, so these numbers may have changed. I don't know about those three counties, but there is a high potential that they all may at least have one brewery that's popped up in their county.
Mm-hmm. One other question in this particular area. We have another topic we want to discuss with Maria. But I will admit, I don't know a whole lot about making beer. I didn't realize, I thought hops were hops. I didn't know there were five different varieties that are currently being produced in Pennsylvania, but not a great amount. And you say, obviously our climate is okay. Heck, in neighboring Ohio, they're producing hops like crazy, I guess, huh?
They are. There's over 100 hop farmers that are part of the Ohio Hops Growers Guild, and they're producing about the same varieties of hops. Technically, there's 15 to 20 hops varieties that grow across the nation, but we're looking at specifically hops that would do well in a wetter climate, which is what Western Pennsylvania is going to be. We don't have as loamy soils as they do in the West Coast in Washington State. We don't have the salty sea air, which would sweep off a lot of molds and funguses. So we have to look at particular hardy varieties of hops that can withstand rainy seasons and dry spells and cold snaps and all of those things that happen in Western Pennsylvania.
Well, there are some recommendations from this research by the university. For one thing, they think growers need technical assistance in growing specialty crops and assistance with creating new market channels. And that's one of the areas where people like Maria come into play and Penn State Extension. Any need for future research in this area, Maria?
Yes, we're really excited. So not just Penn State Extension, but the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture is very interested in the craft beverage market. And the Malt Beverage Board of the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board right now has a grant cycle that several researchers at Penn State University and Penn State Extension are seeking funding right now so that we really can support the agricultural side of craft beverage production. So my team, which is the Craft Beverage Working Group, is looking at expanding our survey across the state of Pennsylvania. So we will then do the same survey to all 293 microbreweries, and we will begin to develop education, workshops, facilitation groups, focus groups amongst farmers, brewers, distillers, maltsters, and get that conversation going in the hopes that we could develop something like the Ohio Hops Growers Guild, and we could have a guild of growers in Pennsylvania that grow specifically for the craft beverage industry.
Well, I could keep talking about beer for a while, but we have another couple of topics to explore with Maria. We need to take a quick break here, but we'll pick up our conversation with Penn State Extension educator Maria Graziani here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after a quick break, and we'll check midday lottery numbers while we're on break, too. Be back in just a moment or so.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick two is 13, 1, 3. The pick 3 is 420, 420. The pick 4, 2182. The pick 5, 19520. The wild ball for each of those is 8. The treasure hunt is 5, 6, 9, 23, and 29. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
That's one of the more recognizable doo-wop songs, recorded by Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, even Elvis. But most well-known is sung by the legendary Marcells. See them perform live at Tanglewood, your hometown center for entertainment, Saturday, November 10th. Doors open at 6. BYOB dinner by Chef George at 7. Showtime at 8. Tickets, $25. Call 287-0021 for reservations.
Blue Moon.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us. We're going your way.
Butler Transit now provides weekday transportation to and from Pittsburgh for just $5 one way. Pittsburgh destinations include downtown and the North Shore. Whether you're looking for a less expensive commute to work or wanting to visit the attractions of the Pittsburgh area, let the bus take you there. Senior 65 and up, ride free with a senior pass. For more information, visit butlertransit.com.
Leave the driving up to us. We're going your way.
The Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot has delicious, all-natural, free-roaming turkeys and chickens to make your Thanksgiving meal special this year. Their birds are handled with extreme care and are preservative and additive-free. Buy your turkey frozen today or get it fresh right before the big holiday meal. For the tastiest turkeys and chickens in Western PA, call the Jones Turkey Farm, 724-352-2450, or visit jonesturkeyfarm.com. The Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot, quite simply the best.
Those turkeys from Jones Turkey Farm are delicious. Holidays coming up. You realize how close we are, folks? Thanksgiving is 2 weeks from tomorrow. Don't want to scare you, but there it is, 2 weeks from tomorrow. Maria Graziani is with us. Maria is a Penn State Extension educator. And I want to talk about land access workshop that's coming up here in our region. First of all, Maria, what is that? What's a land access workshop?
It's a series of workshops, actually. It's going to be 3 days, three Tuesdays in a row in December, and we're going to be walking individuals who are interested in potentially leasing or buying farmland. Maybe it's a new and beginning farmer, or it's an existing farmer who's looking to expand their land, and we'll be talking about all of the ways to plan for buying and leasing land, and also learning about all of the programs in Western Pennsylvania in which you can lease or purchase land, because there's a lot of great nonprofit opportunities for land access.
Mm-hmm. I know, and this is certainly not my area of expertise, but I know just from talking and listening that there are a number of farmers here in Butler County who lease land in addition to their, you know, their farm property. They lease it for crops or for pasture, mainly for crops, I think.
It is not an uncommon occurrence for farmers to lease out their land to neighboring farmers that need extra land. Usually, it is usually for grain growing or it's for pasturing animals.
Mm-hmm. So this is a three-part workshop series, all three parts in December, Maria?
All of them in December, December 4th, 11th, and 18th. They're in the evening from 6 to 9 p.m., and they're being held at the Penn State Extension offices in downtown Pittsburgh at the Allegheny County offices. And we're inviting farmers, potential farmers, and any of the public to attend these workshops, and we're marketing it to Butler County and all the counties north of the city. Because a lot of the land access that we'll be talking about is land access in rural northwestern Pennsylvania. So we're looking at most of that rural land being in Butler and Venango and Mercer and Crawford County.
And we can look forward, I guess, at some point in the future. I'm not sure whether this is completely nailed down yet, but a beginning farmer and rancher program project, too.
Yes, well, actually, this land access workshop is funded by the USDA under their Beginning Farmer and Rancher Program. So that is a larger national program that is supported by the lead project organization, which is American Farmland Trust. And in this 2 or 3 year project, it's really across the nation, there'll be educators educating the public about land access. So Extension happens to be one of the training organizations. So we've been trained in a process that leads individuals through land access. So that's things like, you know, planning your budget, planning your farm project, like what sort of land are you looking at? Land can differ in terms of its soil quality, in terms of its terrain, how much forested versus pasture land there is. And depending on what type of farming operation you want to get into, whether you're doing animal production or vegetable or grain crop, you can plan for the type of land that you would like to lease or purchase.
Wow. You wouldn't have to go back any more than a generation or two, Maria. You know, we're talking about workshops for new or beginning farmers. You go back a generation or two, this was really not needed. I mean, we had many, many, many family farms, and they were generally handed down from generation to generation. I guess that the decreasing number of family farms is nationwide. It's not just something that's been happening here in Pennsylvania, eh?
No, it's definitely a nationwide decline in small family farms in particular. And that's one of the reasons we've got programs like the American Farmland Trust and the National Farm Preservation Program. These are programs and organizations and projects that are set up to make sure that farmland doesn't disappear. And part of ensuring that farmland doesn't disappear is that people actually, you know, people who want to farm are actually owning or leasing the land so that it is farmed and it is growing food for either animal or human consumption. And they all tie together. New farmers who weren't a part of farming families, who didn't inherit farmland, they might have been city folk who decided they want to live rurally and contribute to the food system. And so these land access workshops, which will happen across the country, are really aiding them in the process. Here is how you go about finding and purchasing and planning for agricultural land.
Can you register for these land access workshops online, Maria?
You can at the Penn State Extension website. The easiest way to get to it is just to type in land access series. But you can also go to my work Facebook page, which is Farm Food Extension on Facebook. That's Farm Food Extension. And you will find that event there. And you can hit the ticket button, and it'll take you straight to the workshop registration page.
Finally, in our discussion time with Maria Graziani today, Penn State Extension is going to be hosting several winter workshops on selling beyond the farm stand. Can you take a minute or two and tell us about that, Maria?
Yeah, those workshops we're looking at starting in mid-February next year, and they'll be separate workshops. They won't be like a series, though you could register for all of the workshops in the series. And we're hoping, we're looking at probably a big potential that we'll partner with Sorgel's Orchard in Butler County, or on the Allegheny-Butler border.
Mm-hmm.
And they will host the workshops, which is kind of fun to be able to go out to Sorgel's. And, you know, they've got their year-round market, and they've got Arsenal Cider House there. So we thought it would be, you know, just a place of interest for people to go to. And in these workshops, we'd be talking about everything from, you know, making sure that you have a website landing page, to talk about potentially selling products online through your farm, and planning for winter sales strategy. So planning your crops and then what you will sell through the winter before you get to spring, and then also looking at taking great photographs for your webpage and utilizing social media to promote the products that you do grow and sell.
We all know Sorgel's Orchard. A lot of apples down there. A lot of delicious apples down there.
A lot of delicious apples. And right now they're in the middle of their, you know, fall festivals, or nearing the end of their fall festivals. And those weekends at Sorgel's are very fun, from choosing your pumpkins to the kids playing around to Arsenal Cider House being there and having a great locally made hard cider company. And then they've always, year-round, have a wonderful market at Sorgel's.
Well, how about that? We've talked about everything from beer to apples with Maria here today. How about those apples? Yeah. Once again, Maria mentioned this a couple of minutes ago, but your Facebook handle is Farm Food Extension. Do I have that correctly?
That's correct, yes. Farm Food Extension.
Maria Graziani, Penn State Extension educator, visiting with us. Hey, Maria, very informative today. Nice to talk with you.
Always nice to talk to you, Dave, and thank you for letting me share with the public what we do at Extension.
All righty. I won't talk to you again until well after the holidays, so have a good season.
All right. You as well.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Maria Graziani, Penn State Extension educator. Well, we thank our earlier guest today. We talked with Ashley Brown and, of course, had conversation with Doug Saltzman, political and polling analyst, and listening to his thoughts and analysis on the day after the midterm elections across Pennsylvania and across the country. Always informative to talk with Doug Saltzman. Well, it's Wednesday. We are just past the middle of the week now, since we're almost 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Wednesday over the hump day. Tomorrow, our guests will include John Cyprian. He's the Director of Veterans Services for Butler County. We'll be talking about Veterans Day and Veterans Weekend, actually, activities. Veterans Day falls on a Sunday. The parade, I think, in Butler is on Monday. So we'll get all the details on that from John tomorrow. And we're also scheduled to talk tomorrow with Dr. Nick Newpower, the president of Butler County Community College. So we look forward to tomorrow's edition of It's Your Turn. Hope you can be with us 12:30 tomorrow and every weekday here on WISR for It's Your Turn. Program note, Penguin hockey tonight. The Pens trying to break out of a slump. They've lost.